me, babe. Most of all, I just don't wanna be free, no.
Listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're streaming live on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And before I go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Today, my guests are Jean Hanf Korelitz and Catherine Wald. First up is Jean Hanf Korelitz. She's author of three novels. Her first two books were A Jury of Her Peers, published by Crown in 1996, and The Sabbath Day River, published in 1999 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. She's also the author of a collection of poetry, The Properties of Breath, and a children's novel, Interference Powder. She has written for a number of major magazines, including Real Simple, Vogue, Organic Style, and more. And a couple of Sundays ago, I saw a piece by her in the Modern Love column in the New York Times Sunday paper. She's here today to talk about The White Rose, published by Miramax Books. Hi, Jean. Can you hear me?
No, not very well at all.
Okay, stay on hold.
It's extremely distorted and scrambled. I'm really sorry. I can barely hear you.
Okay, stay with us. We'll get you back on. Well, don't go away out there. We're going to try to get this fixed in the meantime. I am going to put on something for you to listen to, so stay with us. Thank you. Okay, we are back with Jean, and hopefully, except now, let's see what's going on. Okay, we are back, and I am going to put on Jean again. Let's see if we have her. Jean, are you there? Are you there?
Yes.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Phew. We've been having some problems, and they seem to be getting straightened out.
So. Okay, great.
Anyway, gosh, I love your book.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's wonderful. And after I read it, I looked your name up. I didn't want to find out anything about you until after I read the book. And I read a piece that you wrote on Salon about plot. Mm-hmm. And I found it really interesting because as I was reading The White Rose, I was thinking and getting toward the end, while it has such a wonderful literary voice, there's a definite plot going on.
Yes, there is.
And so I really wanted to talk to you about how much you knew about the plot of The White Rose before you began.
Well, I knew a good deal because the novel is based on an opera, and I don't want to imply for a minute that I am an opera person. I actually, not only do I know nothing about opera, but I actually don't like opera. But I fell in love with one particular opera over 20 years ago, and that has really become my opera. And for years I wondered what would happen if I took the characters and the plot of this opera, Der Rosenkavalier by Strauss, and set it down in New York City at the end of the 20th century. That doesn't mean that I remain super glued to the plot, and in fact I had to leave it many times. But I did have a general sense of where I was headed.
So, the way the end works with the story, I can't imagine how you would have written a beginning scene that takes place between all your two main characters, Oliver and Marion, with when Marion's cousin comes over and Oliver comes out as Olivia.
Yes.
Now, yes. Did you know the ending at that point when that scene happened?
Well, I knew where I was headed. I wasn't sure how I was going to get there. Cross-dressing is a big part of Der Rosenkavalier, and I wanted to keep that in the novel. In fact, the permutation of cross-dressing that I ended up with was about the fourth that I tried. So, I had to play around with it quite a lot before I found the one that felt most right for this particular take on the story. But yeah, I did have a sense of what was going to happen.
Can you talk a little bit about the title as well? Because the title, The White Rose, is quite significant.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who always comes up with a title and believes that there's a better title out there. I kept thinking, well, The White Rose is going to be the temporary title, and then the real title is going to reveal itself to me. I did the same thing on my last novel, too. But in this case, The White Rose refers to several things. There's a character named Sophie, who is a graduate student in history at Columbia University, writing a doctoral thesis on The White Rose, the anti-fascist group in Munich in 1942, who were executed by the Nazis. This character, Oliver, that you mentioned earlier, is a young florist in New York, and his shop is called The White Rose. We don't find out why he has called his shop The White Rose until the final pages of the novel, and that piece of information is really the key that unlocks a great deal of his character that has been hidden from us.
Yeah, it's interesting that so much is motivated by the title, and I love it when you don't find out really the meaning of the title until close to the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I love that too, actually.
And then you have wonderful chapter titles too.
That, you know what, for me, that is the great joy. That's like eating the candy at the end. When I get to go through the finished novel and title the chapters, to me that is just pure pleasure. I'm sure it's utterly unnecessary, but that is one little delight that I save for myself at the end of a book.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. If you just tuned in, we are talking with Jean Hanf Korelitz, author of The White Rose. You have written this in present tense with a few point of view characters. Will you talk about that choice?
Yeah, there are three main characters, both in the opera Der Rosenkavalier and in my novel The White Rose. There is a 48-year-old professor of history who is, I think, really the soul of the novel. There is her young lover, Octavian in the opera, Oliver in my novel. And the third character is Sophie, whom I mentioned earlier, the doctoral candidate in history. Each chapter is really filtered through one of their points of view, and I wanted each of them. I mean, I'm not actually very good at first person. I learned this the hard way by attempting to write a few novels that just didn't work very well. But I did want there to be an identifiable consciousness in each in chapters that featured each of these characters. So that, you know, one character may feature Sophie on Oliver, and one may feature Oliver on Marion, and so on. But yes, I wanted there to be an identifiable point of view of one of those three.
In present tense.
Yes, in present tense, with one exception. I decided that although the main thrust of this novel is the end of a love affair, very sad end of a love affair, I, being, you know, a Czech, was very interested in that moment when the love affair begins. And I wanted to see that moment when something just comes into existence that had not existed a moment earlier. And I thought I would write that particular chapter in the past tense. It doesn't occur at the beginning of the novel. It occurs well into the novel when, ironically, we know a great deal about these characters, but then we watch them meeting for the first time.
Hmm. Yes, I love that chapter, actually. I found that interesting coming in where it did.
I actually read it last night in Chicago. It's a favorite to give readings because it doesn't require anyone to know anything about the characters.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us?
I would love to, sure. This is a brief excerpt in which Marion, the 48-year-old professor of history at Columbia, is contemplating the small problem that she has, which is that she's in love with a man young enough to be her son. She's also, incidentally, very married. So in this scene, she's walking down Madison Avenue in New York City, trying to figure out what she is going to do. In the days since her thwarted weekend with Oliver, Marion has felt her most profound wants grow in opposite directions. It pains her now to remember how skeptical she was at the inception of their affair, and her defensive and nearly constant disavowal of anything he said in praise of her or in devotion. Of course, Oliver has always told her the truth. What he wants, he has always wanted from the start, to be living openly with her in a committed way. And what, she asks herself now, is so terrible about that? Whatever friction exists between them comes almost entirely from herself, so what if she stopped resisting? What if she were suddenly unencumbered by the need to punish herself for every moment of pleasure, every surge of happiness, even for the relatively innocuous interludes of mere companionship, all of which Oliver gives her? How would it feel to be actually happy with him, to allow him his own happiness without automatically dispatching the bad fairies to ruin everything? If you could subtract the troublesome, unseemly bits, his being the son of her oldest friend, for example, her being married and old enough to be his mother, then they are actually wonderfully suited. What are we talking about anyway, Marion thinks crossly. Great sex? Interesting conversation? Warm mutual affection? Even Jane Austen would be forced to approve of them. After all, what did Darcy and Elizabeth have that she and Oliver do not? The thing is, thinks Marion, she actually is in a position to make a change in her life, a comprehensive change, if she wants it badly enough. She can actually do what Oliver has asked her to do and survive the aftershocks. This is true for a variety of reasons. Marion has no children. Her husband of many years would recover, possibly very quickly. She can afford to be a divorced woman or marry to a man with more precarious finances than herself. I must be the most fortunately suited situated adulteress in history, thinks Marion. She walks south again, moving among the slender blonde women of the avenue, the shopping women whose work is to pollinate these flower boutiques with money and bring forth the nectar of their merchandise. There may be a reason, it occurs to Marion, watching a lynx-clad specimen paused at the door of Frette, that these shopping women do not age, a reason that has nothing to do with exercise or plastic surgery. They do not age because they are not permitted to enter the decrepit years in public. After their flush is passed, they depart and are replaced by women so closely resembling them in earlier years that, collectively, they maintain the illusion of stasis. Offstage somewhere, Marion thinks, down a private Hamptons Lane or in a grand Berkshire's estate, the prior discards patiently wait out their golden years in meek compliance with the bargains they've made. Their children grow up, unknowing, with a tag team of youthful look-alike mothers, and their husbands underwrite the whole enterprise, compensated with the envy of their peers and the eternal 29-year-old in their beds. How much longer for this one, Marion wonders, passing the lynx woman as she enters Frette, and what happens if she refuses to go at her appointed hour? Marion, as it happens, has never thought of herself as beautiful. Awkward daughters of acknowledged beauties do not long remain unclear on this issue, and Mimi Warburg, legendary hostess, was brutally honest when it came to her only child. Marion's angles were held to be good, and her eye color fortunate. As to the rest, all was camouflage and acceptance of what could not be controlled. Accepted, Marion thinks. She had accepted it, all of it. The ordinariness of her appearance, the predisposition to feel lucky if anyone showed an interest in her. And the odd thing was that she had not resented this, or she hadn't, at least, until a man came into her life and convinced her that she actually was beautiful. Before Oliver, she might have anticipated the years ahead as something subtle, a gentle walk down an elevation so gradual she would not feel the passage. Now she contemplates the loss of her looks with real fear and wishes back her former plainness. Newly baptized as beautiful, all Marion feels is a kind of clutching against age.
Thank you so much. That was Jean Hanf Korelitz reading from The White Rose. I didn't realize you had a poetry background as well when I was reading your book, and it does have a very nice poetic quality.
Well, that's great. Thank you. I did start out as a poet, partly because I was sure I'd never be able to write a novel. But I realized that I was, at best, a pretty good poet. And what I learned from being a poet was to respect language and to always find the best possible word and to make sure that I had exhausted my search for the best possible word. And also to listen to the way the word sounded. Even in prose, it's so important.
Does that happen during the first draft, or is it something that happens as you go on, as you revise?
I find it hard to move on to the next sentence if I don't feel reasonably happy with the sentence that I've just finished. The writing sentence to sentence is a part of writing novels that I feel more confident at. I'm less confident with my ability to make up great flights of fancy and solve the sort of macro issues. I'm a lot more comfortable in the micro.
Interesting. I'm also curious, because you have a point of view character, Marion, who is older than you, and you have a point of view character who is a man, how that is and what the challenges were, really, in writing from their points of view.
Well, many years ago, around the time that I first saw the opera De Rose and Cavalier, I was in a kind of sordid three-way romantic entanglement in which I was the young woman and there was a much older woman. And certainly at that time, I very much felt like the young woman. But as we age, as we all do, you take on the new understanding of the older woman, but you also remember what it felt like to be 25, to be, 22. And I think when it came to writing, in particular, the women in this novel, I was able to sort of be both of them and let them both be themselves at the same time.
Hmm. Interesting. We have a few minutes left with Jean Hanf Korelitz. Wanted to ask you about the other writing you do, which is you write articles and essays. And
yep.
And I mentioned during the intro that I read one by you in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yes.
about your husband.
That's right.
Playing guitar, perhaps, in the basement and going out and playing in public.
As soon as the New York Times started printing these essays on Sundays, I knew that I wanted to write about my husband. And my husband is a poet, but secretly, I suppose, as many other people do, he wanted to be a rock star. And, you know, one would have thought that this would be an unlikely thing to pursue at his age, which is 53. But several years ago, he brought home an electric guitar, and he plugged it in, and he started to teach himself how to play the guitar. And against all odds, he is now in a band with some other men his own age. And you know what? They're not bad.
Mm-hmm.
I was stunned the first time I heard them. They are absolutely not bad.
Well, that was a wonderful essay. And yeah, the column, Modern Love, I love that column that department, because the stuff that comes out is just wonderful.
Yes, it is. I enjoy it, too.
Well, how is it to be a novelist and to write essays and articles? I mean, do they do something for you that is gratifying?
Absolutely, yeah. I particularly love writing articles about women, women roughly of my own generation. A few years ago, I was writing more regularly than now for Real Simple magazine, and I absolutely loved meeting these women, writing about them, learning, entering their lives, not just learning about their lives, but following them around for a day. I met the most extraordinary women, and these are not celebrities, and they were just women who were fascinating and who had figured out some way, not even a comprehensive way, but some way to make their lives work better, run better, but also be more meaningful. And I just, it was such a privilege to do that kind of work. I loved it.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as a writer and as a reader, I appreciate reading other forms, you know, that novelists have essays, have articles, do other stuff. Because if you read somebody and you like their work, you don't want to wait a few years or however
right.
long between books, you
That's
know?
That's right. And I don't want to wait a few years to have to write something that gets published either, which is another great boon of writing these short pieces.
Yes.
I also get to pursue, you know, anything that's a great interest of mine. I can, because I feel that I am representative of my generation. If I'm interested in something, chances are many of us are. So I can usually convince an editor somewhere to let me write about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
A few years ago, for example, I started to play the fiddle at the age of 40. And
uh-huh.
It got me thinking, you know, there must be other women out there who have, you know, been amazed by developing an unanticipated interest in the middle of their lives, and I've just done an article for Real Simple about that. I've got a 40-year-old surfer, and I've got a woman who started acting in her 40s, and it's been really interesting.
Mm.
Doing that.
Mm. Yeah, I love it. Gosh, we have a minute left. I wanted to ask you about you. Your previous two novels were of the suspense genre.
Yeah, the first novels that I wrote were literary novels. They were rejected by everyone on the planet, which should lead you nicely into your next guest. By the time I roused myself to attempt to write another novel, which was quite difficult, I thought, this time I'm going to write a book somebody will publish. And I had an idea for a legal thriller, and that's what I wrote. But having written it and having published it, I found myself trapped in the legal thriller box, and it was quite difficult to claw my way out. But I'm out now, and I'm staying out.
Mm. Well, I love your work, and
I
will continue to look for your name.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.
And I appreciate your calling.
You're welcome.
Bye.
That was Jean Hanf Korelitz, author of The White Rose. We'll have to have her back on. Just wasn't enough time. And if you get a chance, and even if you don't get a chance, go out and check out her book. It's a wonderful one. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. One bit in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We were here the first half with Jean Hanf Corletz, the author of The White Rose, and now we are here with Catherine Wald. Catherine Wald's career as a noted rejectspert began when an early poem was rejected by her high school literary magazine. Although her writing career has been unmistakably marked by rejection ever since, Catherine has been published in numerous publications, including Reader's Digest, Writer's Digest, Women's Day, The New York Times, and Poets and Writers. And she has received fellowships from the Ragdale Foundation and awards from Writer's Digest and Women in Communications. Her work has been anthologized in The Essay Writer at Work, published in 1998 by Heinemann, and The Practical Writer, published by Penguin in 2004. And her most current book is The Resilient Writer, 25 Tales of Rejection and Triumph, just published by Persia Books. She also has a website that we're going to talk about. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks very much for inviting me. I always welcome these occasions when I feel not rejected.
Well, gosh, you know, tell me about The Resilient Writer and how, I mean, it sounds like it came directly out of your life. Talk about putting together this book.
Oh, absolutely, it came out of my life. It really came from a need deep inside me to get past the rejection experience because being rejected was keeping me from writing. And as you know, for a writer, that's death, to not be able to write. So I had written a novel. I spent 5 years writing a novel, and I was so thrilled by the fact that I had finished the novel and had gotten an agent that I was positive that there would be nothing but great things happening after that. Unfortunately, what happened was the novel was rejected by every single publisher, every major publisher around, and this took place over the course of 2.5 years, so it was a long, drawn-out and agonizing process. And even though I had had, you know, plenty of rejections in other aspects of my writing life, such as nonfiction, it was a terrible blow to me. And I was in the middle of my second novel at the time. I found that I couldn't go on writing. So I decided, well, how am I going to deal with this? I'm just going to have to write about rejection instead. So I began brainstorming all different ways to approach rejection. And the first thing I came up with was a website where I and other authors could post our rejection letters and just get that feeling of angst out of our system. And then I slowly came up with the idea for the book, which evolved over the course of 3 different proposals that were rejected, and then finally the 4th version of the proposal was accepted. And the book will be on bookshelves very shortly.
Hmm. So when you were being rejected all during the time that you were rejected, how did you keep going?
Well, I kept thinking that the next letter was going to be the one that was going to be the acceptance letter. That was why that final rejection letter, when my agent said there's no one else I can send to, just really knocked me for a loop. But up until then, it was always the next one, the next one, the next one.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the stories that you hear? I mean, you know, most of us have heard the story of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance being rejected something like 50 times before it got published and
right,
went on to...
Right, that's a classic example.
What are some stories that we probably haven't heard?
Well, there's a wonderful... One of my favorite stories from my book concerns Arthur Golden and his book Memoirs of a Geisha. A lot of people don't know that originally that book was rejected by the agent who had looked at it and told that it was too dry and that it would never become a bestseller, as a matter of fact. And this was an 800-page manuscript, and what Arthur Golden did was, instead of just falling flat on his face, like I think I and many other people would do, he said to himself, well, what's wrong with the book? Because the material is not dry. It's a fascinating culture, and I wrote it because I want to give people insight into this fascinating culture. Well, he decided that he was not close enough to the character. And as a result, the book was initially written in the third person. He went back and rewrote the whole thing in the first person, and it became what it is now. But, you know, it's interesting to me because he had sort of reached a crossroads in his writing career when he got that first rejection. He easily could have given up. I could easily see myself or someone else giving up. But he really didn't, because he believed in the work, he believed he had something to say, and he just wasn't getting it quite right. And I think that's sort of a common factor among a lot of the writers that I've interviewed, is that they don't give up on their belief in themselves as a writer. They just know that they have to get it out in a different way, and they keep trying and keep trying and keep trying until they get it out there.
Have you found that there are certain characteristics that people who get beyond rejection have, the ones who go on to get published, who kind of, you know, just wait until the yeses start coming in?
Well, it has to be persistence. I mean, persistence is number one. I had one person tell me that in his MFA writing program, there were many, many people that he considered to be more talented than he was, but they never became published, and he did, and he said the only way that he could explain that was that he kept going and they didn't. So persistence is a huge part of the equation. And again, as I was just saying, belief in yourself, and not even so much yourself, but belief in the story that you have to tell, belief that it's a worthy story to be told. If you have that and you see to the objective, which is to get the story out there, you're just going to keep trying different attacks and different methods of accomplishing that until you do.
Hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Catherine Wald. We're talking about rejection, and you have a website that's pretty much focused on rejection.
Yes, I do. It was just one of those crazy ideas. I think I came up with it at the time that websites were just really becoming popular, and it seemed to me that a website would be the perfect way for writers who have to get their emotions off their chest about rejection to do so. And I set it up so that you can plug in, you can get onto the website and plug in one of your rejection letters, you can put comments about the rejection letter, or you can tell it in the form of a story of a particular rejection that you had, or a story of a rejection that you had that later turned into a triumph. So there are a lot of different formats that you can use, and then I read through all the entries, and yes, I accept or reject them. I accept almost all of them, and I post them, and then people, you know, who are having a bad day or who just got a rejection letter in the mail can go and read all the other rejection letters and stories from people, and some of them are depressing, some of them make you laugh, and some of them are very inspirational. So between all those different kinds of letters, you get a feeling that you're not the only person who's going through this, that you can get through it, and that other people have survived it. I know some people from the publishing world have looked at these rejection letters and the responses and been very taken aback at how personally writers take a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And my response to that is that this website is not really for the publishing world. It's really for the writers, and it's just meant to allow them to vent and get feelings out of their system And the end goal of that is so that they'll start writing again. It's
yes.
not to create any animosity between the two camps, because really writers and publishers are all on the same team. We're all in favor of good books and good writing and good reading.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Catherine Wald, author of The Resilient Writer, published by Persia. And her website is rejectioncollection.com. Do you think, have you seen in terms of, you know, rejections that people talk about, that good writing really does find its way out there? Or are there good books that just sort of, you know, end up sitting on the shelf because they just cannot find that audience?
Well, I think where that...
Or good articles or stories or poems.
I'm sorry, I missed the last thing.
Or articles, stories, or poems. I'm not really talking just about books, but you
right.
know.
I think a lot of it has to do with timing. I think a lot, because when you approach, for example, a magazine editor, they may have just published something about the subject that you're interested in, or someone else may have come to them with the same idea. It seems like there's certain ideas that pop up at certain times, and everyone seems to have them. So you may just have bad luck to be the second person to come up with a certain idea instead of the first person. And I think the same thing is true on the bookshelf. I mean, I'm sure there are many, many fine books that are sitting out there on bookshelves that are just not getting the exposure that other books are getting just through sheer bad luck. But in terms of getting your work published, I think there's a lot more that people can do than they think they can do. You really don't need to feel totally helpless about getting your books published. I feel as if a lot of the reasons writers get frustrated about rejection is you have a feeling of not being in control of your fate and not being in control of the fate of your work. So what I recommend to people when they get rejected is look at some aspect of this process that you can have control over. So you just got rejected by X magazine, but that doesn't stop you from putting the article back into a letter and mailing it out to Y magazine. Your first novel was rejected. That doesn't stop you from writing your second novel. That doesn't stop you from joining a writing group and getting critiques of your first novel and trying to rewrite it. So always look for that thing that can keep you writing and keep you going and keep you moving on to a higher level.
You know, it's interesting how few rejections certain writers get, and they think it's just a disaster. I was doing a talk the other day, and somebody said, oh, I have a friend who was rejected, her manuscript was rejected, and she just doesn't know what to do. And I said, oh, how many times was it rejected? And he said, four. I said, four. Four.
That was a hearty laugh, by the way.
You know, I mean, four times.
For some people, one is too many.
Yeah.
And for some people, zero, because they just don't send their work out at all. And I really think that's a shame. I think you really have to get past that. Just one of the people I interviewed in my book teaches in an MFA program, and the last assignment he gives his students is send out a story and get a rejection letter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you need to start collecting those letters just to know that you can get them and you're not going to die and you can keep on writing and you can keep on submitting. You have to just make this a part of your discipline as a writer, and don't be afraid of it.
Don't you think that that often is sort of the dividing line? It's like if you can't take it, then ultimately you will either just write for yourself, you'll journal, you might seek self-publishing, but if you can't take it, you just will not send your stuff out.
Well, that's absolutely true, and you have to learn how to take it, and that's really a lot of what my website and my book are both about. I mean, when you go on the website, you will see some incredibly nasty rejections that people get. One of the nastiest ones was to a poet telling her, you know, she just wasn't meant to be a poet. Meanwhile, years later, she now is a poet with published books and is teaching herself. So when you look at those things on the website, you realize that you're talking about one person's opinion at one time of the day, maybe right before lunch when they were hungry. And you can't take it too seriously. You just have to chalk it up, you know, make another little notch in your bedpost or hang the letter up on the wall or post it on my website or do whatever you want with it. And don't dwell on it. Just keep moving.
Yeah, a story I like to tell is of a writer, Tom Paine, who now has a couple of books out, but he said that he received a rejection from The New Yorker for a story. I guess he'd been sending them stuff for 10 years. He'd been sending his stuff out.
Okay.
Nothing was ever picked up. And then on the same day that he got a rejection letter for a story he sent to The New Yorker, you know, just to the slush pile, to no editor in particular, he got a phone call from another editor at The New Yorker that he actually sent the story to. He had a name. He sent it to her, and she called the same day and said, "We would like to publish the story. We just need you to, you know, tweak it here and there."
You know, that is just perfect, and I've heard stories like that so many times before. There's one that Wally Lamb tells in my book about a particular literary journal that he sent a piece to, and it came back rejected with a form letter. And a few weeks later, he forgot he had sent it to the same journal, and he sent it out again. And the second time, he got a letter with an acceptance. And then shortly after that, that literary journal gave him their annual prize. And as a result of that, he got an agent. And as a result of that, he got another prize. So things just can be very capricious in the way they play out. You really have no idea why one piece is rejected one minute and accepted the next moment. And that's another reason to have faith and to just keep trying.
Talk about how failure can kind of give you a kick in the butt and perhaps make you go even stronger in the direction of what you're seeking, which is to be published.
Well, Bob Shakochis is one of the authors in my book who told me that whenever someone tells him he can't write something or he can't do something or this is something he's not allowed to write about, it just makes him write all the harder. It energizes him with anger. And I think, you know, anger is one of the responses that people have to rejection. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, you have to be careful how you express the anger, of course, and not to get innocent people in the way of it. But to feel angry can energize you to go back and rewrite something. Go back and look at it again and figure out, is this person really right about this story? Go out and read the story to someone else or show the story to someone else and prove that the other person is wrong. I've seen a lot of people on my website who were very energized by the anger that they felt at rejection and did eventually get accepted.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Catherine Wald, author of The Resilient Writer, published by Persia. You know, books and journals are not the only things that writers are rejected by that can be discouraging, but there, more and more writers are thinking they should go for MFAs and applying to MFA programs, and when you get rejected from an MFA program, there's another level of, angst and depression because you go, oh, I can't even get into an MFA program to improve.
Right.
Will you talk about that?
Well, you know, rejection never ends. There are so many ways that you can be rejected as a writer, and it's not just MFA programs. It could be that you're not invited to read at a certain reading, or you have a reading and no one shows up, or you get a lousy book review. But in terms of MFA programs, I have to say that there are two different writers that were interviewed in my book, both of whom were universally rejected by every MFA program that they applied to. And one of them never got an MFA but just kept writing, and the other one went on to get a journalism degree and then went back to get an MFA degree and kept writing. So I wouldn't let that discourage me at all. There are plenty of good people out there writing who don't have the degrees, and there are plenty of other people that go back and apply for the degree later on. So that's my advice about that.
Sure. What did you learn in writing this book?
Well, I learned a couple of things. I learned that, first of all, writing is just not an easy thing. I mean, haha, didn't I already know that? But in a deep way, I learned what a complicated and complex process writing is, and the fact that you just can't get everything right the first time. I mean, to expect a first novel to be perfectly wonderful and perfectly publishable is a little bit too high of expectations. And the other thing that I learned is that successful authors have all the same problems that other writers have. The only difference is that persistence that I was talking about. When they reach an obstacle, when their book is rejected, when their manuscript is rejected, when they can't find an agent, when they can't find a publisher, when they can't get into an MFA program, they just look at those events as obstacles. They don't look at them at the end. They just keep going. They go around the obstacles, they go over them, they go under them, but they just keep moving and they refuse to let them stand in their way.
Yeah, I think part of what troubles writers at times, what troubled me with my book, Pen on Fire, was that, you know, the first couple of rounds, the first couple of agents I had couldn't sell the book and in the state that it was in, and so I just, you know, made it disappear for a couple of years until it just was nudging me, and I brought it out again and sort of gave it another pass, found another agent, and this time it sold well and has been great. But there are other projects that have been rejected that I have put away and will never bring out because, you know, I'm just not interested.
Right.
And so I think sometimes when you're getting rejected, it's sort of like, you know, really listening to yourself and being able to discern whether this is something you really should continue to pursue or you really should give up.
Right. That's absolutely right. There are some projects that really were just not ready to be completed and not ready to be published. And sometimes the only way you can really find out the truth to that is to put them aside. If you put something aside for a couple years, it will either keep haunting you so much that you have to go back to it, or you'll feel a sort of a sense of relief and you will not feel that need to go back to it. So time is a really important test of that.
You might even feel thankful that you didn't get it out there, because how embarrassing it would be to have something.
Oh, yeah. Many of the writers that I've interviewed have told me, oh, my God, I'm so glad my first three novels didn't get published. There was even one person who told me, oh, my God, I'm so sorry my first novel got published. And he saw someone at a reading who had bought a copy of that first novel, and he felt so guilty about it that he gave him a copy of the new book just to make up for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're all so anxious to get our stuff out there, and sometimes we just need to slow down.
Yes.
And make it as wonderful as it can be, and then see what can happen.
Right. The time pressure sometimes is our enemy. You know, our culture is so into instant gratification, and, you know, you can pretty much publish something yourself just by doing it on your computer, and we feel like everything should be very fast, but In the writing process, there's room for slowness, and slowness plays an important role. And sometimes the best thing you can do for your work is just putting it aside for a period of time and then taking it back up again and see how you really feel about it.
We're getting to the end of our time. I wonder if there is any story that really kind of sticks out beyond the others that you heard or were told for the resilient writer.
Well, let's see.
Or maybe even an ongoing theme that you heard from a number of writers regarding the whole process of being rejected and persevering.
Right. Well, Janet Fitch is a favorite interview of mine, and she told me some stories about her children's experience with rejection and how her daughter saw her crying at the mailbox, and in circle time in nursery school, her daughter said, they were asking, what do you get in the mail? And everyone said, oh, we get a letter from grandma, and we get a catalog. And her daughter said, we get rejections. And at that point, she made a comment to me that said, you know, people on the outside, in other words, people who aren't in the writing profession, look at all the published writers and think that that's all there is out there, but they don't realize that for every book that's published or for every magazine article that's published, there were 100 writers who went to their mailbox and cried.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just something we need to remind ourselves. The odds are very much against us, and we need to know that. We shouldn't be surprised when we get rejected. We shouldn't feel like it's the end of the world. We shouldn't feel like it's the universe telling us not to be a writer. It's just part of the process. And if we can keep that perspective, it just makes it so much easier.
Yeah, that's so true. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
And it'll be great to meet you next week in New York.
I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks a lot, Catherine.
Okay, bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye. That was Catherine Wald, author of The Resilient Writer, published by Persia, just coming out right around now. And she also has a website, rejectioncollection.com. And where I'm going to see her is at the ASJA conference next weekend. The American Society of Journalists and Authors, of which we are both members, is holding the annual conference the weekend of taxes. So most of you will have filed your taxes and can take off and celebrate. Of course, I'll be filing an extension as usual, even though I've had the bag of receipts on my desk for weeks now. I don't know what it is. I put it off and do other things that are more fun, unlike most of you, which is, I wish I could develop that habit every year. I say this year I'll have it done on time. Anyway, you can find out more about the conference by going to asja.org or going to my website, penonfire@earthlink.net. Wait a minute, that's my email address, penonfire.com. And click on appearances, and there will be a link there to the ASJA website, and you'll find all the info you need. I hear it's almost sold out. There's hundreds of people, 600, 700, I don't know what number we've hit at this point, but it's almost maxed out, and it promises to be a wonderful weekend with a ton of literary agents, a ton of magazine editors, a ton of authors, and on Sunday, workshops on writing essays and query letters and book proposals. It's quite well priced, and especially if you know somebody in New York you can stay with. It's not an expensive conference to go to, and well worth it. A lot of writers get work from going to the ASJA annual conference. Anyway, if you want to reach me, you can email me, as I said, through my website at penonfire.com or just directly penonfire@earthlink.net. And I want to leave you with a quote by Alice Walker, who said, "Deliver me from writers who say the way they live doesn't matter. I'm not sure a bad person can write a good book. If art doesn't make us better, then what on earth is it for?" Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and James should be here soon with Between the Lines. Stay tuned, and come back next week.